Hello.
Let's do it.
Hello and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 117. Today is April the 15th, 2009. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offer further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either omitted or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your television off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. I believe that our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability, and that the prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. I suggest you find your role. Okay, hi everyone. Thank you, Bruce Coburn, for Action Speak Louder, the track we just heard. Right now we're listening to DJ Shadow, that'll be followed by Ashley McIsaac.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
So what do I have for you today? Show number 117. I have an interview, telephone interview, with Barry Zwicker, the author, journalist. He's also one of Canada's leading 9/11 truth activists. Many of you have his book, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. If you don't, I suggest you read that. He's a media critic. He's also taught courses on media and society at Ryerson University in Toronto, as well as being a part-time professor for 7 years. He's also worked on Vision TV's media, has been their media critic since the multi-faith network's inception in the fall of 1988. That lasted until 2003. He has taught journalism for 7 years at Ryerson. He's published the magazine Content, which is a journalism review, and has written for newspapers such as the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, Detroit News. So this is the first time Barry's been on my show. That seems kind of surprising. He's a big influence on myself. As a matter of fact, it was Barry Zwicker that turned me on to 9/11 Truth. I saw on the internet part of his first... Well, see, what happened is Barry is the first journalist in the world that deeply questioned the official story of 9/11 on national television. So that's pretty big. Is it called the Great Deception, I believe, is the name of that. So, yeah, Barry Zwicker. I also have a couple other things. I'm not too sure how long this is going to last. We are a three-hour difference, so I'm pretty much going to give Barry the time that he wants, and as long as everything's staying good. one of the reasons Barry's on right now is he's going to be speaking at the Edmonton Edmonton Questions event, in which Barry Zwicker, as well as Robert Balsamo, who is with Pilots for 9/11 Truth, those two will be speaking May 2nd in Edmonton. So well done, Edmonton, there. Okay, other things we're going to look at tonight. I have a piece by Rafe Mayer. Now, he's a writer, political commentator, and a former radio personality as well as BC politician. He's been speaking out about saving our rivers from Gordon Campbell's private energy agenda. That's the first piece we're going to hear. After I tell you what's on today's show, we're going to start with that. So, Rafe Mayer getting involved in the political campaign that is upon us, calling to get rid of the Gordon Campbell government and what they're doing to our resources, selling them out to multinational corporations. Very, very frustrating. That's what this vote comes down to, according to Rafe Mayer. Okay, other things. Oh, I have a piece on water fluoridation. Yes, and if you're in the Nanaimo area, you have fluoride in your water. This is an audio piece by Dr. Bill Osmondson, a dentist, longtime dentist, and he has a lot to say about water fluoridation and believes that, well, if you look on tube of toothpaste, it is a warning. It's a drug, and if you overdose, you got to call, the appropriate medical people. Why are we drinking it? Why are we drinking it? So we'll go into that. Also, a new author to myself is Dr. Stephen Greer, and he is with the Disclosure Project. Now, I'm not too sure if I'm going to get to this piece tonight, depending, again, on how long the interview with Barry Zwicker goes. But so let me tell you a little bit more about this. If you visit their website, disclosureproject.org, you will find briefing points for a congressional hearing and legislation from the Disclosure Project. So Stephen Greer is the director and founder of the Disclosure Project. And what it is a non-profit research project working to fully disclose the facts that UFOs, unidentified flying objects, that extraterrestrial intelligence, and classified advanced energy and propulsion systems. Now, this Disclosure Project has over 400 government, military, and intelligence community witnesses testifying to their direct, personal, first-hand experience with UFOs, ETs, ET technology, and the cover-up that keeps this information secret. And, as you know, this whole 9/11 trip has been really something on me, and I, you know, kind of have a somewhat of a grasp of what's going on, and it's absolutely frightening, but I guess I keep want to ask questions, and where I'm at right now is looking into the evidence that suggests, or in Stephen Greer's case, he says that proves that we do indeed have a long relationship with our brothers and sisters out there in space. That's, we're the little kid on the block, and we're, what are we going to do? We're going to put weapons in space to, who knows, shoot off these other species that I believe have been watching us and maybe even taking part for many thousands of years. So, carrying on here, what the audio piece, this is what we're getting to by Stephen Greer, is this takes place at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., May of 2001. And this is his opening remarks to this conference at the press club, and this is what it has to say with that YouTube clip. A large number of ex-high-ranking officials, including air traffic controllers, ex-secret officers, commercial pilots, numerous military defense specialists with top-secret clearance, people who have had access to very sensitive documents, lieutenants, ex-commanders in the U.S. Air Force, astronauts, etc., all of these people are going before the National Press Club to discuss what their experiences have been regarding UFOs, and all are willing to go before Congress to testify under oath. Never before has such a group come forward. So that's Stephen Greer at the Disclosure Project. I suggest you take a look at that. Maybe a David Icke piece, a couple songs here and there. So that pretty much does it for today. Again, the Barry Zwicker interview, that'll be happening in about 10 minutes. Next week is the fun drive. I'm going to have Bob Hansen and Jesse, pretty sure it's Schroeder is his last name, in-studio guests next week for the fun drive. I'm really looking forward to that. So please, if you can, call in during next week's show and make a pledge. That would really be nice. Okay, I think I've covered pretty much what's going to be happening. So, do I want to touch again on Barry Zwicker? I think I will. First off, he's currently writing a book about the history of false flag operations. And this is a quote that in email exchange over this last week. Barry Zwicker writes that while 9/11 was the most brazen and arguably the most impactful, it was, looked at numerically, just one among hundreds that have repeatedly derailed the human journey into the ditches of war and multi-generational grief. Take just the burning of the Reichstag, the German parliament in 1933, orchestrated by Hitler as a key stepping stone to his seizing power, as an example of history-changing false flag operation. Almost all the false flag ops of history have been mounted by the oligarchy of the day to serve their perpetual agendas of greed, power, and control. So we're going to be talking about false flag operations. He also wants to take a look at the big picture. And what he says about this is that we're definitely going to need a substantial fraction of humanity, a much bigger percentage than we have right now, is going to have to come to understand the complexities of the jam we're in. And that's, you know, understanding that, well, our vote and our governments aren't really in charge of our countries. It's a level of power and control above that. I'm not saying don't go out and vote. I certainly want you to take part in every political action that you feel comfortable doing. Okay, well, that's a long enough introduction to Barry Zwicker. What we're going to do now is listen to the Rafe Mayer piece. He's speaking on behalf of Save Our Rivers from Gordon Campbell's Private Energy Agenda. A website you can visit is saveourrivers.ca. So, there we are. Of course, you're listening to CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM from Nanaimo. We're also online at chly.ca. You can listen live streaming from the top right corner of the homepage. Click on the lo-fi. Don't hog up too much bandwidth on us. So there we are, friends. This is the Unbought and Unbossed show. Stay tuned for an interview with Barry Zwicker. Right now we're going to listen to Rafe Mayer. Oh, no, you know what? Actually, no, we're not. We're going to hear the weather update. Silly me. But I can bring that up pretty quick, I think. All right, well, that's been fairly quick version of the BC or the CHLY weather update. Am I supposed to say anything more? Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. That is being brought to you by the financial supporters of this show and CHLY, and they are Edmonton 9/11 Truth, which they have extended their business membership with a $150 donation from Edmonton. So thank you. They will be continuing with us with another year. And so that leaves Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth and Victoria 9/11 Truth. You have one more week to decide if you got the cash. And I'd love to keep repeating your guys' names because, you clearly understand the importance of independent media. And that's what this show is about. We're talking about things that, well, you're not going to hear on your TV. And if you do, you know, they're going to try to make fun of the ideas that you get on the show. And that's the way it is, isn't it? So as long as we have independent media, and so long as the internet is free, it's far from over, is what I would like to think. So I think we're at the point now that we're going to get to that Rafe Mayer. I've only said that 14 times tonight. Okay, friends, I'll have Barry Zwicker on the phone when we get back.
This is British Columbia, where I've spent my whole life. I don't own this land. I use it in trust for Indigenous peoples' title and rights, for the salmon and the bears, for the eagles and the orca, for my community, and for all who come after me. At Save Our River Society, we're calling May 12, 2009, our watershed election, because that's when British Columbians will choose their destiny. This is the most important provincial election we've ever faced, where we decide whether we preserve our sacred rivers and historic public power system, or mandate Gordon Campbell to continue giving them away to some of the world's biggest corporations. For the past 6 years, our autocratic premier has been quietly surrendering our watersheds to private companies to make expensive, environmentally destructive power, whose enormous costs will be passed on to us through huge rate increases, while ultimately bankrupting BC Hydro. Over 600 rivers and streams already have applications or licenses on them. Though invaluable, these licenses cost the companies virtually nothing. In this watershed election, we choose between saving our fish and wildlife, our majestic forests that help fight climate change and give us our clean air, or destroying them with private river power projects we don't need. Do we follow the far right-wing Fraser Institute, where Premier Campbell worships, that says everything must be privatized, including our public assets and the most beautiful landscapes on earth? Or do we preserve our heritage and fight to keep our rivers, their ecologies, our public power, and our sovereignty? Thanks to many sacrifices over the past 50 years, we enjoy a public power system and energy security that are the envy of the world, providing us with the lowest power bills and cleanest electricity in North America, while yielding up to $1 billion a year in public profits, keeping our taxes low while paying for health care and education. All of that will be lost if we give Campbell and his private energy agenda another 4 years. This is our watershed election, where we must take back our environment and our power, together, united across our multicultural communities. The damage Campbell's private power policy would do to our economy is incalculable. The damage to our environment would be irreparable. Either we reclaim our province on May the 12th, 2009, or we abandon our very soul, our heritage, our British Columbia. Join us in the battle to save our rivers and our public power. To learn more, go to saveourrivers.ca. For Save Our Rivers Society, I'm Rafe Merritt.
Okay, very nice. That was Rafe Merritt speaking out about a topic of, great import, since we have the provincial election coming up. So, of course, Rafe Merritt is a writer, political commentator, and former radio personality and BC politician. He is really concerned about Gordon Campbell's government and their privatizing our energy, our rivers and such. And so saveourrivers.ca is the link for that. Okay, I do have on air, as promised, author, journalist, and one of Canada's leading 9/11 truth activists, Barry Zwicker. Barry, welcome to the phone.
Good to be here.
Hey,
good to be here.
Thank you very much. It's the first time you've been on this show, and I feel bad about that. And so thank goodness you're here with us.
Don't feel badly.
well, one of the reasons is we have a friend in common, Doug Brinkman in Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
He is putting, the Edmonton 9/11 Truth Edmonton Questions. This is their second one, and it's going to feature yourself as well as Robert Balsamo,
mm-hmm.
Pilots for 9/11 Truth.
Right.
So that is is that your next 9/11 lecture? Do you have any in the meantime?
No, that's my next happy visit, and I have a brother, Richard, living in Edmonton, and so I'll be getting there a couple of days early and leaving a couple of days late and make it also a family visit.
Oh, fantastic.
But the Edmonton 9/11 Truth Group is just so active, and they're really a model of activism, and I've got their website up in front of me right now, and it's
very
just
nice.
So vibrant. So I really hand it to them all the work they do, all the outreach, is just terrific.
Yeah, there's a fun piece that they do called 9/11 Speakers Corner,
mm-hmm.
in which they go out almost weekly, certainly a couple times a month, and interview, you know, people just like you and me on the street that, you know, have something to say.
Indeed.
And what a refreshing, you know, tool this is. You know, the internet and these various activists that are getting out there and, you know, trying to create the change that they want to see.
Well, yes, and you know, it's actually, in my opinion, Raymond, this is actually very deep in a way what they're doing. Here's what I mean.
Okay.
I've been in journalism and communications all my life, since the age of 17, when I started to work on a weekly paper in Manitoba. And then I taught journalism and I worked for the Globe and Mail for 8 years and so forth. So I've been in this all along, and of course I became around 1970 a media critic. And at first I was always called a self-appointed media critic, but after a while, Vision TV started to pay me, to be a regular, media critic on that channel for about 15 years. But in any event, of course I've been critical of the media, of the mainstream media especially, and even of much of the so-called alternative media on the matter only of 9/11 truth. Because with wonderful exceptions such as your own program, even the alternative media have been very slumberous, you know, at the switch. Well, anyway, the point I'm getting at is this, that the media are in big trouble now, as we know. Daily newspapers are suffering grievously, and they're newspapers that have stopped publishing regularly. And their ad revenues are falling. Television is also in trouble. I think probably you and your listeners all know that. So one of the losses, if we lose a lot of daily newspapers, which certainly seems to be in the cards,
mm-hmm.
will be investigative journalism. Now, newspapers don't do enough investigative journalism, in my opinion. Nor does TV, but at least some. And if we lose those, we lose investigative journalism. The other expensive work that the mainstream media engage in is overseas bureaus, and these are very, very important too. And of course, they're cutting back on those. At the same time, there is, for a variety of factors, the rise in what's called citizen journalism and citizen journalists, and it so happens that the biggest journalism investigative project on the face of the earth now is the 9/11 truth movement.
Mm.
And the work in Edmonton is a good example. These are citizen journalists / activists. And of course, we also have in the 9/11 truth movement, and if any of the listeners aren't familiar with it, I guess we'll we'll go into it a little bit as you wish. But we have in the 9/11 truth movement what I call the biggest investigative journalism project on the planet. We have physicists like Dr. Stephen Jones. We have architects and engineers. We have authors. We have some academics. We have some politicians. In other words, it's a multidisciplinary project too, which is what the best of the investigative journalism has always done. I mean, the major newspapers would even hire lawyers who were adept at journalism. I've known several of them in my career, so that they could bring in the legal aspects of a case when they're pursuing it. So the work that they're doing on the streets of Edmonton, and there are many others in many cities around the world, are part of something that maybe even be more important than they even know themselves.
Yes, I'm very curious to see how history is going to be written in the coming future, now that there does seem to be a rather great divide building between, you know, the traditional corporate-based, media, newspaper, television network versus, you know, the internet culture and the publishing culture. Very interesting times. Of course, historically, you know, you were talking about news agencies. They were never a for-profit venture. It was well understood that, you know, you're going to take a loss when it comes to news. And, you know, as we know through the years, they've glitzed and glammed up news in which they're, you know, it's info news, you know, it's infotainment news.
All too true. All too true, Raymond. And we are, as you mentioned a moment ago, at a turning point. I mean, it's a cliche, I suppose, at different times in world history, people have said that things are at a turning point, and there have been turning points in history. And I don't think it's an exaggeration at all to say that we are certainly at one today. We're at the intersection of, it is the paradigm shift that began, I forget when the term paradigm shift came into the language. I believe it was really in the 60s. There was a particular author who wrote a book called Paradigm Shift. I forget his name. But now it has really hit. And we have what Marshall McLuhan called, I was privileged to be able to take his course for 3 years.
Nice.
And he called it Speed Up. And this was way back in the late 60s when I took his course.
Okay.
And even then, he, being the genius he was at communications, saw the significance of speed up.
Mm.
Partly it was the arrival of the electronic age, where with instant communication around the globe and so forth. But now the speed up has invaded almost every area of life. And at the same time, there's something that I call scale up, so that you have these bigger and bigger events, like giant corporations just hanging in the balance, and they have to decide in 30 days what they're going to do.
Mm.
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And it's also highly significant. There are many, many aspects to it. One is, that's a positive one, I think, is that pattern recognition, again, that was a big thing with Marshall McLuhan, that pattern recognition comes into its own much more when there's speed up. It's like time-lapse photography. And when things unfolded at a slower pace, people wouldn't necessarily see what was happening, you know. But when they happen so quickly, then the pattern is right there before your eyes. So that's a positive thing. A negative is that there's not enough time to really pause and reflect, you know, and absorb what's happened before the next huge development hits. So it's a most interesting, important, crisis-ridden, and perhaps partly hopeful time that we live in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point. I think there was another book just a few years after, Future Shock, Alan Toliver, I believe is the name.
Yeah, Future Shock, Alvin Toffler, right.
There we go. But again, I recently saw a YouTube clip, and what a fantastic thing we have in YouTube, as a matter of fact, suggesting that the rate of increased knowledge, if we can call it that, or bits of information today with our computer technology, and how we could, you know, for example, we might learn more in one day of the New York Times newspaper than we did in the entire 17th century, you know, for example, to, you know, pull something out. So there is this huge increase in different knowledge and the specialization as well. It seems that if, let's say, a young college student takes a 4-year degree, well, the things they learned in the first and second years might be considered to be obsolete, that the shift is happening so swiftly. And to stay on top of, you know, especially if you're, you know, a scientist or a doctor in one of those fields, boy, you know, talk about this speed up and future shock. It's certainly to be a handful to deal with.
It truly is. The ramifications, we can't even understand them. They talk about, we can try to and perhaps understand to some extent and should certainly try. But there's this, these unintended consequences of various actions that we take, sometimes in our individual lives, but then larger, right up to the actions we take as a species. And, So the future is really to some extent up for grabs, and it could veer off in almost diametrically opposite directions. What I mean is, for instance, when a society becomes terribly stressed out through economic upheaval, for instance, It could also be environmental upheaval, which is more and more happening, and regrettably, almost certainly, is going to happen more and more. It's not a separate topic. These topics are all intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's economic distress, we saw, for instance, with the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 30s, that when there's massive unemployment and people and the value of people's savings is dropping and so forth, people can turn fascistic. They can turn in search of a strong leader to solve all their problems. That's a terrible danger in times such as we're living in now. But it could also go the other way, because this isn't the 1930s, especially the communications technology is far different, as you've just noted, and so that it could be a time, and it is already in part a time of democratic growth and the flourishing of things such as citizen journalism, and generally the escape of so much knowledge into the general public, whereas the knowledge used to be just guarded and hoarded and kept by elites. So knowledge is power, of course, is the old saying, and a very true one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is why it is such an interesting time. And 9/11, which I believe is the main, the nub, I believe, of what you wanted us to talk about.
Well, that is my strong point, and it's certainly one of yours.
Yeah.
So, yes, if you want to lead into that, please do.
Well, 9/11 is right at, to me, anyway, is a central case, an important and a continuing case in point about the changes that are needed in the world, and the changes that may be within reach to some extent or another. What I mean is that all through history, you mentioned history a few minutes ago, very important. In the book I'm writing, I saw that I was forced to begin the book in its first draft by asking the question, what is history? And
okay.
Then going on to ask,
okay.
You know, who makes history? Who
sure.
decides what history is? But in any event, as I understand history, the really after civilization, as we call it, was established in Sumeria or Sumer, when agriculture became established, and there could be a division of people into different specialties, such as farmers, accountants, people who made fabrics and so on, which wasn't possible prior during the hunting and gathering phase of humanity. Everybody just hunted and gathered.
Let me include goldsmiths.
Yeah.
That might be a good profession that started back in that era.
Yeah, indeed. The gold has always been much valued, and as that's a good point. But in any event, through history, this is strictly a matter of opinion, if you will. The way that societies came to be governed was through oligarchies. In other words, you can be governed in a dictatorship by a single person. If you have some form or other of democracy, then you're governed by the many. But usually what's happened is that we're governed by the few, oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And regrettably, and you could see that with monarchies. Monarchies were oligarchies, monarchical oligarchies, and that's happened all the way up through history. It still is mainly an oligarchical form of governance, really generally in the world today.
Yeah, I use the term plutocracy in my opening monologue.
Very good. Plutocracy, absolute synonyms.
Yeah.
Absolute synonyms. We're told we have democracy, and indeed we have some democracy. We shouldn't engage in what's called surplus powerlessness and say, well, we don't have any democracy at all. That's not smart. We do have the power to go out in the streets. We have the power to write letters to the editor. We have the power to get out and campaign for people, to run for office, and so on. These things are not meaningless. But at the same time, what's generally hidden from us is that powerful interests And we're talking, for instance, the arms industry and the oil industry and the pharmaceutical industry, the monopoly capitalist enterprises and so on, have an undue amount of sway in our governance because they can more or less buy candidates. You know, they through their think tanks and their whole networks, they can scout for promising young people, young Tony Blairs, young Bill Clintons, young Stephen Harpers, and then usher them into the halls of the mighty and prepare them and bankroll them and coach them, and then they're in their pockets.
That certainly sounds like the Obama story south of us.
Well, it just seems that it's virtually impossible to get to that stage where you would run for the presidency of the United States and be free
and be independent
of this huge influences by the likes of the Council of Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing is that it's possible that the grip of the oligarchies, just possible, no more, I say no more than that, could be at least weakened, and would be for the betterment, probably for the betterment, so long as we didn't go in the direction of fascism, probably for the betterment of most people of the grip of the oligarchy, what I call the diaboligarchy, because we have a diabolical oligarchy.
Yes.
And it would be better if it was weakened, and 9/11 is a key there, because all through history, the rulers have engaged in deception, of course they've engaged in deception, and many kinds of deception, telling lies in the form of words and promises and so forth. All rulers don't lie all the time. I don't want to be extreme, but generally speaking, the people who come to be members of the oligarchy or the power elites, also the invisible government is a good term that I use anyway. They have a hunger for power. You also have to look here, in my estimation, actually have to look at human nature. You have to look at all that we can summon about how human beings develop and so forth. And there are some humans who are attracted to power. Unfortunately, some fraction of them, perhaps 5%, are actually psychopaths. They're people whose wiring is wrong in their heads, and they cannot feel empathy.
Yes.
But I have a friend, psychologist friend, who says the higher you go in any organization, the more likely you are to encounter a psychopath.
Right.
And in any event, the people who are attracted to power, they have a skill set. For instance, they will lie, they will cheat, they will browbeat, they will blackmail, they will seduce, they will bribe, they will use the whole bag of tricks in order to gain power. And once they get to power, they use that same skill set to maintain or expand their power.
Mm.
And that is why, you know, things just generally turn out badly, because you get oligarchies. And I think that's a big lesson that humankind generally hasn't understood. One of the reasons being that the oligarchies have actually controlled history by and large. They, you know, there's that saying that history is written by the victors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there's an awful lot of truth to that in the full sense of the word awful. And so generally speaking, people don't appreciate the extent to which power elites control our lives. They don't control them completely, but they control more than most people understand most of the time. And especially on the large matters of life and death and bread and butter issues. So one of the best tricks, and in fact the book I'm writing is just on false flag operations in history, and is called False Flag Operations, History's Deadliest Deceits and Why They Matter. And so one of the favorite tricks of the oligarchies has been to pretend, to arrange, to fake an attack on one's own country and then blame it on another country, the true intention being to attack that other country, steal its resources or whatnot. And this has happened over and over and over again. Arguably, the most impactful false flag operation of all time is the case of the events of 9/11, which were, in my opinion, and there's mountains and mountains and mountains of evidence, it was an inside job. Elements of the U.S. government did that. And the alleged 9/11, the alleged 19 crazed Muslims were just patsies or dupes. There's no evidence that they even boarded the plane.
That's right.
Let alone all the rest of the story.
Yeah.
So, always previously in history, the expose of a false flag operation has been only partial and very late. I mean, there's a certain fraction of the population now knows about Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese were provoked and that the military base at Pearl Harbor was deliberately left vulnerable. The commander wasn't told that the Japanese fleet was on its way. None of this excuses what the Japanese did, but the point is it was set up deliberately so that America would be attacked, or there'd be a big loss of American life, and it would enable Franklin Roosevelt to join the war against Germany. And, you know, you can argue that's a good thing even. I'm not, you know, I rather think it probably was. But the point is that it wasn't the historical event that it was portrayed as being. It's just simply a day of infamy where the Americans were caught completely off base by this sneak attack, you know, quote, by the Japs, unquote.
Yeah.
And so 9/11 was, as David Ray Griffin's book has it, a new Pearl Harbor. But it was even worse than Pearl Harbor, because actually was carried out by elements of the U.S. government, and there may have been assistance from other governments. And I'm thinking specifically that the CIA must have been involved, and Mossad may well have been involved. There's more and more evidence, in fact, that Mossad had some kind of a hand in it. And if you ask the question, who benefits?
Yeah.
The leaders of Israel, especially Benjamin Netanyahu, who's now the prime minister again, who actually said publicly that 9/11 was good for Israel. So that answers the question, who benefits in the instance of that particular ruling clique in that particular country. Nothing I'm saying here is anti-Semitic. I insist and would defend to the death. I'm not talking anti-Semitism here.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking realism about who benefits from these things. So this is all by way of saying how important it is to get out the truth about 9/11, because it's the Achilles heel of the current oligarchy, and its power needs to be tempered if the world is to have a safer and saner future.
Yeah. Now, I'm not aware of another history text based solely on false flag operations. However, there are a number of 9/11 truth publications that do, you know, list many examples. Is yours the first on this subject?
Well, it's actually rather incredible that my answer has to be yes. I've done quite some time ago. I began doing literature search, and I may have missed something, but I can't see that there's ever been a single book published ever just on the subject of false flag operations. There have been books about particular false flag operations, and Robert B. Stinnett's book on Pearl Harbor, called Day of Deceit, is an excellent example. And of course, there have been books where chapters were devoted to particular false flag operations,
yes,
the Reichstag fire,
yeah,
in Germany and so on. But curiously and almost amazingly, not a book just devoted to the subject itself. And I must say that I actually had the idea for this book going back to the summer of 06. I can't believe we're at 09 already.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably struggled with about a year, not full time or anything, just on the definitional difficulties and challenges of false flag operations.
Okay.
So I've begun to see others have started such a book and were defeated by it. And I don't think I'm going to be defeated by it. It's advancing, but it's certainly challenging. One of the reasons being that there have been so many of them.
Okay.
And another thing is that they take so many forms. They're extremely difficult to categorize. I must say, by the way, if I may jump in here on my own self, I guess I'm jumping in on myself, that you may or your listeners may be familiar with a wonderful publication called Global Outlook.
Thank you. I was going to bring that up sometime tonight.
Okay. So Global Outlook published, the editor and publisher is my dear friend and colleague Ian Woods, and I'm one of the two contributing editors, and Ian and the other contributing editor, Terry Burrows, and myself are in the very final stages of, regrettably, the final issue.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, number 13. Ian's going to continue on with other things.
Okay.
And, but in any event, this is, it looks like it's about 268 pages, and the theme is false flag operations.
Wow.
I'm very happy to say.
Okay, so you're going to be playing a large role in that issue as well then.
Yeah, I've got about a 10,000 word article in it, and so that should be out next month, probably.
Okay.
Maybe about a month from now, I'm guessing.
Okay, Ian agreed to an interview. He wanted to wait until the edition was out and available before he comes on this show.
Yeah, well, that's very good. I'm so glad that that's in the offing. And indeed, just today, I mean, because of this aforementioned speed up, we've seen that there are certain articles and certain topics, for instance, the advent of Obama and all sorts of ifs, ands, and buts about what he can and cannot do and what he represents and what he, and so forth. And that's only one of many topics that are bubbling around, and that Ian, who always is very open to new information and to replacing information with even newer information, this is one of the things that's extended the production of this, because it should have been out already, but with various developments, Ian will send to Terry and I a new article and say, hey, should we include this?
Right.
And so we do our comments, but it's really coming together, I think probably this weekend, the final, you know, we'll have to just do the final say-so about what's in and what's out.
Okay, very nice. Now, Global Outlook is called the, I guess, the official magazine publication of 9/11 Truth Community. Is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, the nameplate on the front cover. I'm just digging out a copy. It's called the Magazine of 9/11 Truth.
Okay.
But in this very final edition, I have the cover. I can't just access it instantly. It's on a file here somewhere.
It's really more like a journal.
It's more like a journal, and the Magazine of 9/11 Truth subtitle is being dropped for the cover of the final edition.
Okay.
And it's being, and the cover of the final edition, it's really a book, and it's called A False Flag Exposé Issue.
Okay.
That's the approximate wording.
Okay. Well, you played a huge role in the previous issue number 12, looking at the media's response, the corporate media's response to the 9/11 issues and the 9/11 movement.
Well, yeah, Ian had so much to do with that, but I agreed to go over all these articles and do these commentaries on them because I was a media critic for so long. But, But we've already discussed the media.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I was going to suggest that your book, which I have in my hands right now, Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11, was personally one of my favorite read of the different 9/11 texts.
Mm-hmm.
I have quite a few. I don't have them all. However, you did include a chapter dedicated to false flag operations, so you're expanding on your initial research.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Chapter 7.
That's right.
Yeah, and the book will be just, it'll be a whole book based on Chapter 7.
Yeah, very nice. I don't know, it sounds like maybe you don't. My favorite chapter from this is The Shame of Noam Chomsky and the Gatekeepers of the Left. We have touched on media, but that was a very strong piece, and it's not too often that someone takes Noam to task. Has there been a response?
Oh gosh, yes. I'm gratified that you found that a useful chapter. And the fact of the matter is, well, the first fact of the matter is that when I wrote that, when I was proposing to write it and drafting it, And there were about six people that were helping me, that I was sending them drafts of chapters and asking them for their opinions and for their suggestions. It's very, very helpful. And with that chapter, first of all, I'm not sure it was six people, but let's say it was six, because, you know, it varied from time to time.
Okay.
Whether I could get stuff out to people or not, and whether they were available. But anyway, let's say it was six, and what I remember clearly is they were completely split down the middle. Half the people that, and these are colleagues, you know, these are supporters, colleagues, helpful people, and knowledgeable, and good writers, several of them better writers than I am.
Yeah.
And they were split. Half of them said, you can't do this. This is just terrible. You know, the Noam Chomsky is so beloved.
Is the hero of the left, yeah.
Yeah, and the other half said, go for it, go for it. And there was no question that I was going to go for it. And then when I finished it, still that split was there. And some said, boy, you're going to regret this. This is really bad.
Oh, no.
So
yeah.
Okay, that's part one. Part two, it is the most popular chapter in the book.
Okay.
No question.
There we go.
Feedback I've had is just so positive on that. And people have said, it's so gratifying. They've said, thank goodness someone is writing this. I thought that myself. And it's so good to see somebody else really spell it out.
Okay.
That's 15,000 words on that. And then, of course, it was very gratifying to receive emails from people all over the world saying, you know, I thought maybe there was something to this, and it's terrible to write, but thank you for doing it. We need to hear this kind of stuff.
If I can, Barry, steal 1 second. Listeners, we're listening to a conversation with Barry Zwicker, the writer, media critic of Toronto. And what we're talking about is Chapter 5 from Barry's first book on 9/11 studies, Towers of Deception. And the way Barry sets up this is that both you have a quote of George Bush and Noam Chomsky really belittling looking at 9/11 by calling it a conspiracy theory. And, you know, that really gets your blood to boil. And, you know, you basically suggest that Noam is using that term in the exact same way that George Bush is intending, like, shut up, don't go in there, or you're a loony.
Exactly.
You know, and so that was the start of the chapter, and you know, it certainly keeps you reading from there.
Yeah. Well, it's I appreciate that. And I will be returning to that subject to some extent. It's not clear how much in the book I'm working on now. I think it may be a bit of a longer book, and it probably be deeper. It deserves to be deeper. Whether I'm deep enough to meet the challenges that remains to be seen. But in any event, I think that I can't escape dealing again and further and deeper with these gatekeepers of the left, because they still exist. They're still operating. And I know a lot more about them now, partly thanks to feedback that I've had from readers who said, did you know about, you know, Alexander Coburn saying this? Do you know about Amy Goodman doing that? And so forth. And so that, regrettably, the fact of the matter, and I use that phrase deliberately, the fact of the matter is that the CIA, there are probably other intelligence agencies also, but the CIA probably remains the main one, have planted over many years now numerous agents within the media. These are people operating under deep cover. There's very few of them would ever be caught out, and they've worked themselves into choke points in the media where they are TV producers on major news programs and their editors on major papers and so forth. And their task is to operate as normal employees, you know, almost all the time, do their job, but on certain issues that are critical to the diabolicarchy, such as the truth about 9/11, such as the truth about the Kennedy assassination, the truth about Martin Luther King's assassination, the truth about Robert Kennedy's assassination and Malcolm X's assassination and the assassination of Paul Wellstone. And so on these deep, dark...
The big ones, yeah.
Yeah, secrets of the oligarchy, their job is to choke off all original reporting or investigation that they possibly can, and also, of course, to spread disinformation. The disinformation about the Kennedy assassination continues, 45 or so years later. And power, the influence, the impact of this cadre of these moles really has not been recognized properly. And to some extent, in fact, to a great extent, it's actually provable that they're operating. It's a funny thing. It's not exactly that you can see them directly or name them directly, of course. That would be a chancy and laborious and difficult standing process.
That would be difficult. However, I will point out that Michael Rupert, in his 9/11 publication, did name some names that he believes are, you know, exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, Mike is good at that because he knows about these agents of the state. William Pepper is another person who's very good on this, and well, there are quite a few people actually. But in any event, they're in science sometimes the existence of some kind of particle can be seen by the trail it leaves, even when they can't see the particle itself. You know that phenomenon. As a matter of fact, there's dark matter in the universe. This is great mystery. It actually exists. They know that, but they can't see it.
Okay.
And the reason they know there's dark matter, for instance, if you listen to the CBC radio science program Quirks and Quarks, is that when they look at a very distant galaxy that is behind a galaxy, they can see that the light is actually bent. You know, there's things called redshift and so on. And in any event, it's indirectly that the existence of certain forces of gravity or dark matter and there's also dark energy, the existence is evident because of the effects of the unseen forces. So you posit or theorize that they are there. But it's very strong theory, very strong. Same way with agents of the state. You look at the actions or inactions of the media and see how, as you mentioned the previous issue of Global Outlook, how the media just across the board refused to investigate even the most patent absurdities of the official 9/11 story. Paper after paper, TV station after TV station, and you start to ask, could this be coincidence? And then you see it can't. It's like the dark matter. I mean, if you want to go back to the Bible, and Jesus said, "By their fruits ye shall know them." So, in any event, I do believe that I have an obligation to deal with that again and further.
Do you believe that there's any in Canada working for, say, the National Post?
The answer is yes,
okay.
And not just the National Post. Indeed, the National Post, Stuart Bell on the National Post, and I actually refer to him in my book Towers of Deception.
Okay.
He has such close connections with the spy establishment that it's embarrassing.
Right. Okay. Interesting. This leads to a slightly separate topic of those that are in the media that, you know, well, maybe not moles, but they are self-censoring themselves. And that would be obviously a far greater number of editors and reporters that, you know that it probably is not wise to my career if I follow this lead.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I agree with you. And I'm actually maybe will be able to pull up something here that I could look at that I wrote earlier today, as a matter of fact, to Ian when we're polishing up the conclusions to this coming issue of Global Outlook.
Okay.
And one of the questions that we're asking, if I can find it here, I'm sort of just looking for time, and I see by the clock that it's a minute after midnight.
Yes, it's... Thank you. I'm talking to you in tomorrow already. Yeah.
You're gonna have to kick me off the air here pretty soon, I think. but in any event, if I can just find it here, the question is, how could so many media, in such a broad brush fashion, all be colluding in the cover up of 9/11? And actually I'm not finding what I want, but I can tell you from memory that there's, in my opinion, a small batch of reasons.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
One is that many journalists are stuck in various ruts. And in fact, for them, for these journalists I'm speaking of, and they're not all necessarily in ruts, but let's say in grooves, that it's not within their job description to start asking questions about 9/11 and talking their editors into investigating it and publishing or broadcasting.
Okay.
So right away you've got a lot of journalists who are kind of deselected from the gene pool of truth seekers on the question of 9/11. And then there's of course careerism because journalists, you know, they want to stay employed or get promoted or get raises and so forth, which is all very natural careerism, and so they would be those who are particularly career oriented are shy away from anything really controversial, that's big, as I say, and then there are traditions of journalism which work against the real vigorous and enthusiastic pursuit of the truth. For instance, this he said, she said journalism, which is just another way of saying that the journalist shies away from taking a stand as to whether something is true by just saying, well, this person says A and the other person says B, and so I'll let the reader or viewer or listener make up his or her mind. And so there's another thing. And then you have, of course, overarching, you have the form of ownership of most media, which is corporate. And so the corporate owners have a value system. And at the top of the value system is growth and profit. Well, nowadays it may be survival and not losing too much money. That's how quickly things are changing. But traditionally, capitalism believes in growth and profit.
Forever and ever, amen.
Mm-hmm. And so that the value system of the owners, of course, is reflected in the top executives they choose, because they choose people who will see the world the same they do, and then those executives choose the other editors and so forth all down the line. And so the whole organization becomes suffused with the value system of the owners. And so that's another thing. And then, of course, there's the aforementioned moles. But if you want to look at probably the most important of those various factors, and there are others too, but of the factors I've just mentioned, the ownership is the key, because although it isn't true in all cases that the owners know that there are moles on their staffs who are choking off certain information and promoting other disinformation on these key topics, but they have known quite often, they have known that they're harboring these people, and they've done it consciously, we have historical evidence of this going back to the Church Committee in the U.S. Senate in the mid-1970s, when Operation Mockingbird, a big CIA operation to control so much of the media output, was revealed and exposed. And so there's no reason to believe that they ever stopped doing it, and in fact there's every reason to believe that it's much, much bigger than it was when it was exposed by the Church Committee in the mid-70s. And isn't it a curious thing that there has not been, since the mid-70s, any serious investigation of the role of the CIA in American life and globally.
Or the Fed we can add as well, which is, you know, the CIA and the Fed are the two bad guys on most people's list.
I would agree. I mean, there's your money power and your surveillance and your spy power and your secrecy power. And those are two pretty major factors in how life has been lived and the way things are working out now, which isn't all that great.
Hey, being a bit of a media expert, there is something I'm hoping you might be able to help me out with. I can't confirm it myself, but it has to do with the Council on Foreign Relations. In the mid-1920s, they may or may not have conspired to learn what they could do to control the major media print at the time. Do you know that story, and can it be confirmed?
I don't know that story. I have not investigated that. I have not become knowledgeable, haven't run across information about that. However, it doesn't mean that something a little bit useful might not be said, and that is this, that in the broader span of history, again going back as I did a few minutes ago, right back to Sumer, right, and by the way, it was in Sumeria that writing was invented. It actually was originally it was accounting. It was numbers, because once they had an agricultural economy going, that they began to food became a commodity.
Yeah, you have to keep track of what you got.
Yeah, and if you keep track of how many pecks or bushels or whatever was unit of measurement, and that you were selling at what price and so forth. That's how writing actually began, and then which numbers, and then it developed into letters, and that's where written language was invented. And but in any event, all through history, starting then, I think it can fairly safely be said as a vast generalization. Rulers have, of course, known the power of information, the power of which there are several sides to that power. One is, the flip side is secrecy. And so, and that's what the CIA engages in, and another side, of course, is spreading information or disinformation. And another side is to what extent you play up this and play down that. And every newspaper every day has to make those decisions, what goes on the front page, what goes above the fold, and what goes below the fold, and what goes inside, what goes deep inside, what do we not publish at all. That's the power of omission.
Yeah.
And so rulers have always known this, and it would be extremely surprising if the Council of Foreign Relations did not understand that and go beyond understanding it to take action in order to control, for the purposes of those elites, as much information as they could.
Okay, to summarize what may have happened is that they learned that if they controlled either the owner or the senior editor of the 25 most influential publications, that everyone else would have to follow their lead. So, you know, you were just speaking on that exactly, and it seems to make sense.
Well, and what you say seems to make sense. I mean, this just wouldn't surprise me at all. It's just too bad that I'm ignorant of the history of the CFR.
They're very secretive, so it's not easy to get the goods out on them.
One thing we do know is that the CFR, as indeed is the case with the Bilderbergers and other elite groupings, invite media that certain powerful and or influential members of the media to join them.
Yeah.
And one example that springs to mind is Bill Moyers. Now, a lot of people, and I'm one of them, has great respect for Bill Moyers.
Likewise, yeah.
Yeah, and it could be that Bill Moyers has decided, he's no dummy about the ways of power, and he's proven that with a lot of excellent programs.
Yeah, he's told a lot of truth over the years.
He really has. He even ventured into truth about Kennedy's assassination. Anyway, so I would tend to want to cut him some slack, give him the benefit of the doubt, and say that he realizes that when you're invited to join the CFR, you are then thereby becoming, to some extent, a member of that elite, And that's something that you have to, you know, account for in your soul. But on the other hand, it also can be an opportunity to find out how do these guys operate and so forth. And indeed, a lot of the spy work is that kind of a negotiation. It's well known in spy circles that information is currency. They operate with money, yeah, sure. I mean, they bribe people and blackmail people and everything. But probably the primary currency is information. And so they will trade it. And life can become, it's not black and white. And everyone has to compromise. The question, you know, the thing is that we have to know the point past which compromise becomes betrayal.
Mm.
But we can't just be saints on this earth and never be exposed to other people or forces or inducements that, you know, that may or may not be a slippery slope. I think a lot of us can tell when we're in danger of being corrupted and avoid it. And thereby, you can tell us because we're poor.
Oh, okay. Not bad. Well, let's start to point in the direction of wrapping this up.
Sure.
You have a new book coming out on false flag operations throughout history, and it sounds as if this might be the first publication specifically at length on that subject. So it sounds like it's going to be ready fairly soon, and who's going to publish it?
Well, I think I have a publisher. I've made a query, and so we're in contact. I have done some books in the past. I've had publishers, and also I've done self-publishing.
Okay.
So I know, you know, there are pluses and minuses each way. I mean, I'm certainly going to do this book. Publish this book, and whether it has a publisher or whether I self-publish is a question to be decided.
Okay.
I'd rather have a publisher, be that as may, the publication date was supposed to be this year, because as I said, I really started it in 06, but it can't happen this year. It's very evident that it's such a challenge. There's so much research remaining to be done. And what I could say with as much certainty as I can summon, because we never know what's going to happen for sure in the future, I very much plan and hope that this book will be well and truly available before the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Mm.
Because the 10th anniversary of 9/11, of course, will be significant. There's an American cultural critic, the name is Ray, I think, last name is probably Ray, and he said, quote, anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power. And you just have to look at the way Americans, on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, you know, it's just a deep wound in their national psyche that they memorialize every year.
Okay.
And also, one can pretty well predict that there's going to be a massive rollout of the official lie during the 10th anniversary commemoration of 9/11.
To further solidify those that, you know, you and I might be getting to slowly, showing them the errors of the 9/11 story.
Oh, they'll never give up. I mean, as I say, they're still sowing really active disinformation about Kennedy's assassination. I mean, there must be a whole separate unit of the CIA that just works on that full time.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, money is nothing to them. They have practically endless monetary resources no moral compunctions. So that it would be naive in the extreme to think that the attempts to sell the official lie of 9/11 will not continue apace, and efforts to delegitimize those of us who question 9/11 will also continue. And so we have to, if you will, we have to live with that. Mm-hmm. It's an historic reality. However, you never know your luck. And the 9/11 Truth movement is still growing. 9/11 Truth is still expanding. More and more people have suspicions or more about 9/11, and also recognize still the significance of it. In a way, the perpetrators of 9/11 are sort of caught in a catch-22 situation, because in order to continue to promote their agenda of the so-called war on terror and all the hyper-militarization and everything that goes with this, and to continue to conduct these false flag operations like the Toronto 18, you know, and all and
the 7/7 attacks in
London, 7/7 and the Spanish train bombings and everything. So in doing these things to keep alive the so-called war on terror and all the excess militarism and surveillance and all the rest of it that goes with it, they have to keep referring back to their official lie about 9/11. And so and they continue to prop up this target, in other words, that we're very legitimately shooting at. And so they have to keep telling the lie, and as they keep telling the lie, they keep alive those of us who want to strip the lie bare. So it's a curious situation.
I wonder if I can play devil's advocate a little bit.
Please do.
Persons like yourself that are fairly well known in this truth community, what would you say to someone that says, you know, Barry, you're only hastening the accelerated police state in the West?
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to, if you will, take your chances. Because we don't know. Mark Twain very well pointed this out in his delightful story about the stranger and the dervish, and it's a story in which the reader is shown that it's very difficult to say what is a good action and what is a bad action. So you know, the stranger asks the dervish, you know, well, look, if your uncle died, would that not be a bad thing? The dervish says, well, what if the uncle left me a lot of money? So, you know, and similarly, I think that my friends in the gay community, for instance, they had this big discussion for years, you know, whether to come out of the closet and be loud and proud.
Yeah.
And they were split down the middle on that. And they said, no, you know, we should just keep a low profile. We don't want to trigger, you know, homophobia.
Okay.
And others said, no, we got to be proud and we got to flaunt it. And in fact, that's the title of a book that a gay friend of mine published called Flaunting It. And it turns out that the people who were wanting to be loud and proud and to flaunt it were right, because that is the way that you gain rights. In a democracy, there's an old liberal, small L liberal maxim that I learned at the University of Michigan. They have rights who dare maintain them. And as soon as you just cower and say, well, I mean, there is such a thing as biding your time, you know, and choosing, you know, your time. I'm not saying that that's not true. But generally speaking, people who have a legitimate grievance, or they're legitimately working for justice and truth and so on, had better be loud and better go for it. Because when you just keep a low profile, then, you know, the other guys are going to win.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, what will happen, but I know that, I believe, that is, that when I look at history, I see that people generally made a mistake when they didn't stand up and proclaim their own beliefs fearlessly. And a lot of people who did that died, yes. But on the other hand, generally, that's how people from below, rather than the elites, can make a difference. There are those who say that Tom Hayden is one, you know, wonderful U.S. politician. And he posits that there are essentially two groups. One he calls the Machiavellians.
Okay.
That's what we've been calling during this conversation the power elite or
That's
the invisible
right.
government.
Yeah.
And the Machiavellians. And they have a lot of power. They're very sneaky. They'll use any means possible in the interests of the most privileged, overprivileged, and overly powerful and overly wealthy, you know, groups in society that the oligarchies. And then opposed, if you will, to them is what he calls movements. that some people would say the people, but people have to be organized. So he, anyway, the way he puts it is you got Machiavellians and movements, two M's. and so movements are really the only, way I know of, or almost not, you can't generalize completely like that, because there have been, odd cases in history where just an enlightened ruler, came along, Alexander the Great or whatever, and just did good work for his people, even though he was a dictator or was a member of an oligarchy or a monarchy. But those are the exceptions that prove the rule. And generally, people have to take power away from the elites that always get too powerful and become very despotic. And so the 9/11 Truth Movement is, first and foremost, a movement. And thank goodness it's leaderless. You know, there are no leaders. And that's one of the great things about the movement, and if it pushes in a way that brings horrible push back from the power elites, that's a chance you have to take.
Okay, well, that was a pretty good answer. The analogy of the gay community coming out, the debate of should we or shouldn't we? So good answer, thank you.
Yeah.
So carrying on, you are going to be speaking in Edmonton at the second Edmonton Questions 9/11 event this coming May 2nd, yourself and Robert Valsamo.
Yes.
Of Pilots for 9/11 Truth.
Yep.
You've been to an awful lot of conferences over 9/11. I think we met in Vancouver in 07,
yep.
And I think you might have said that this was your 18th or 19th event that you'd spoken at. Do you have a current tally?
Oh, gosh, no. I just haven't kept track. And as a matter of fact, Raymond, I've been turning down speaking engagements by and large because, you know, to focus on this book.
Okay.
I'm not not nearly as self-disciplined a person as I'd like to be. So what you have to do really is say, well, there's only so much time, and try to set aside what I call writing shifts, you know, where you just go and you go into a cone of silence. You tell your wife, I won't take any phone calls or answer the door or anything. And,
yeah.
And part of that is to turn down, public, engagements. But again, because I'm, not rigidly self-disciplined, I go ahead and accept some anyway. And of course, when I do, I'm tremendously enriched because I meet people, I hear different points of view, and interact with people, and I learn a lot. So what I realized is it was really wrong to completely cut off these events, these engagements, which I had done for about 9 months, and just to accept a few is probably best.
Okay. Okay. Apparently this week we can add one more Canadian truth group, perhaps number 25, Vernon, which is in the interior of BC.
Marvelous.
So one more group is up there doing their thing. So maybe I'll hear from Mike in future weeks, and he can tell us what his plans for 9/11 activism are in Vernon. So congratulations to that new group.
Well, and this is the first I've heard of it, and I'll just add my congratulations right now, here and now.
Very nice.
You know, something might be mentioned here, Raymond, and
sure.
That is that some groups and some individuals within the 9/11 Truth Movement have become, well, once in a while somebody says they just burned out, you know, what happened to Mike Rupert at one point. You hear people just saying, sometimes they get a little bit down in the mouth and they say, well, we're up against such terrible odds and there's so many people don't understand, and it's possible to become demoralized a bit, and some people just burn out, and some people lose their energy, or their life circumstances change and so forth. But I must say that And I just received an email today from Truth, what's it called, in New York, it's centered in New York City, I think it's called Truth Move,
yeah.
Truth Move,
okay.
They have a nice website, And email came out from one of the organizers, and he was saying this very thing, that that some people in the New York group have fallen away, and that sometimes they wonder, you know, how much headway they're making and so forth. And I've heard that from every group, including our own people here in Toronto.
Okay.
And but I think it's absolutely wonderful that, first of all, there's always a core. I mean, to my knowledge, none of the 9/11 truth groups, more and more of them, have just faded completely from the scene. And even if some had, I wouldn't be alarmed, because this is a normal life cycle for even corporations. I mean, you learn that in business school. You know, there's the startup phase, and then there's the maturation phase, and then there's the fade out phase, and that happens to our lives too. So there's naturally going to be a certain rhythm to any group. Sometimes there's a strong leader who drops out, or sometimes there's more than one strong leader and they start to fight. And my dear friend Carol Bouye in San Francisco, for instance, she of course is just a dynamo, and she started that group there. And what happened was that the group sort of became unruly and rebelled actually against her, and they voted her off the island.
Oh no.
Yeah, they kicked her out. And it's interesting to hear her tell about it. And then later on they found out, well, that was a mistake, because, you know, she's just carrying on her activism there.
She's
out of
one
Palo
of the
Alto.
Best, she's one
and,
of the best organizers I would suggest that we've seen come out of this movement.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And of course she's like the Energizer Bunny. She doesn't stop. And so then later on she got invited back. And so, I mean, I don't want to treat this lightly, but the thing is that there are ups and downs in the life of any organization. And also they're going to, and another thing is that some people tried to make a big deal, not people so much within the movement, but people outside the movement, tried to make a big deal out of whatever splits they may have seen in the movement. Well, of course, some of these splits were engendered by these agents of the state that infiltrate a movement, you know, and intentionally destabilize it.
Right.
But insofar as the tensions are normal, shall we say, and caused by personality or principles, I never find that something to become alarmed about, because I mean, what organization doesn't have tensions and, if you will, even divisions within it? I mean, can we look at a corporation or a church or the Republican Party or any organization? There, you know, there's always these splits and differences and so on. In every the caucus of every political party gets split on issues and sometimes on personalities and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what is it? Like, well, why should we take it, you know, as a horrible thing that's fatal, if there are differences of opinion or even splits, of which there are very few, in the 9/11 truth movement? I mean, it's like the Russians have a saying, everything's normal. Everything's normal. That's what Russians say, no matter what's happening. They have a history, you know, that has to lead them to think that. But I figure that's also true of our movement.
Okay, well, snafu came to mind. I'm hoping that's not the case.
No, let's hope it's not snafu. That's a World War II term.
Okay, the final thing is that you told us tonight that the issue number 13 and perhaps the final edition of Global Outlook, the magazine of 9/11 Truth, will be out shortly, it sounds like. Yourself and Ian are putting wrapping touches on that publication.
Yep.
So very nice, and that means I'll have to get after Ian in the near future and set up a date for him to come on the show.
Oh yes, I believe he'd be very pleased, and he you know, is the heart of that publication, and he's familiar with every word and every comma in whatever it's going to be, 268 pages or whatever.
Wow, very nice.
And he's a wonderful person, a wonderful friend and colleague.
Hmm.
So I hope that the issue will be widely distributed and sold, and I think it's going to be very useful. Regrettably, it won't be ready now, we know for sure, in time to be handed out at the May 2nd 9/11 Truth event in Edmonton.
Very nice.
But what we're going to do is print maybe 10 pages or so of it.
Okay.
Print the front cover and about 10 pages and then an order form on the back.
That's right. You did that with the last issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You're really up to speed, Raymond.
Well, I brought home a bunch of those from the Vancouver conference and distributed them to the people here in Nanaimo. It was a little bit larger than 10 pages last time, but it was a heck of a nice, and plus it was a good reference guide to other videos and publications.
Ian calls that a catalog.
Yeah, there you go. There it is. We've been listening to Barry Zwicker, an author, a journalist, media critic, well-known Canadian 9/11 Truth activist. Barry, I would like to thank you very much for taking the time. It's 12:30 your time, and you did mention that you've had a scratchy throat, and boy, we're lucky it held together quite well. So, unless you're going to go and cough for 2 hours after this.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to cough really loudly.
Well, thank you once again for coming out, and I hope that the Edmonton get-together, Edmonton Questions, goes very well, and I wish the group in Edmonton all the best for that event. So, Barry, we're going to leave it at that.
Well, and thank you so much for inviting me, Raymond. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the chance to be with your listeners, and they're what it's all about. I always say, you know, the medium is just a sort of a necessary evil between whatever the world has to offer and the readers, listeners, or viewers. So your listeners, they must have a lot of gumption to stick with one and a half hours here.
I give them a lot of credit there. I consider my audience to be, top notch as far as, well read and well internet savvy. Another thing that's kind of neat, I'll just close on this, is next week is our fun drive, and we're an independent radio station, so we get we wouldn't survive if people didn't donate funds to this independent media project, which is, CHLY.
Yep.
It's so next week is Fun Drive, and I have been trying for the last 2 years to make this show, the only one that kind of takes that extra step over the fence into the 9/11 land. I've got the only political show that does that at this station, and I have been in the top five, and I believe in a couple of cases the top three money generators, and I'm trying to get it to number one and to let the other programmers know that our listening audience is further ahead than our programmers.
There you go.
So, I've got a lot of respect for the listeners here, and they truly understand the importance of independent media, and so I guess I'm just pushing that event for next week. So,
well, good for you, and I join you in pushing that fundraising event, and it doesn't surprise me that the 9/11 truth-oriented listeners are generous and concerned. And this is why it's a great privilege to be any part of this movement. It's the most, I've been with different organizations in my life, as I mentioned, Globe and Mail, Vision TV for 15 years, which is a wonderful, wonderful 15 years. And yet, the 9/11 Truth Movement has introduced me to more wonderful, passionate, knowledgeable, concerned, and funny people than I've ever found in my life. It's just an absolute privilege, and being on this program is just another example of it.
Well, fantastic. That's greatly appreciated. Barry, thank you for the final time.
And thank you.
All right, partner. We'll be in touch in the future, I hope.
Very good. I hope so. Thanks.
All right.
Raymond.
Looking forward to your the publications that are on their way out.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good night.
Okay,
be
bye.
Well. Oh, how cool was that? Barry Zwicker. That was, I don't know if I said this on air, but Barry was the one who turned me on to 9/11, and I don't know if it was a little bit of idol struck or star struck. I was just kind of nervous about, I kind of propped this fellow up on an imaginary pedestal that, he had some really important information, and I was, the student, and anyway, so I kind of walked through that one. I'm really glad that Barry was on. Now, I suppose the next person that I have a little hang-up of soliciting for an interview is David Ray Griffin. So there we go. I've got one more mountain to, well, no, I've got lots of mountains to conquer, but, so there we go. I think you know what I'm saying. Okay, this has been, well, it continues to be the Unbought and Unbossed Show on CHLY 101.7 FM. I do archive this show. You can listen to past episodes as well as visit my website and find out exactly who we were talking to, suggested websites, different audio clips, you know, just anything that I talk about on a certain show, you're going to find links to those various organizations and writers and whatever the case may be. So if you would like to ever check out my website, listen to past shows, the address is Unbossed, U-N-B-O-S-S-E-D, unbossed.livejournal.com. I'll repeat that in case someone's getting a pen. Unbossed.livejournal.com. If you would like to contact me, that would be fine, too. Maybe have a suggestion for a topic on a future show. So you can get a hold of me at Raymond Truth Radio. RaymondTruthRadio at hotmail.com. So I've got to come back and take care of the events calendar. I've got some audio pieces that I'm going to play concerning the fun drive next week. You know what? I already have $250 of pledges lined up. I'm going through my little black book and calling my loved ones and saying, you know I do this show. You know how important it is to me. If you can spare it, please donate a little bit of money to CHLY during the fund drive. So I'm going to be back with you shortly. And what we're do we have time? Oh, shoot, to get to that Dr. Stephen Greer at the National Press Club. That's concerning the Disclosure Project. Well, we'll just see what happens, won't we? See you in a minute.
Okay, we've got another edition of 9/11 Speakers Corner. Today we are back at Churchill Square, downtown Edmonton, at a rally against the war in Afghanistan, put together by the organizers of Echo War. The crowds are a little bit smaller today in comparison to other events of rallies and parades in the past. Perhaps maybe 30, 40 people showed up today to listen to some of the excellent speakers that were on hand. We managed to hand out quite a handful of 9/11 public newsletters, and we were very quite fortunate today at the very end of the rally. Our own Bruce St. Clair of Edmonton 9/11 Truth and Pilots for 9/11 Truth was on hand to say a few words about 9/11 and the fact that we too will be holding an event downtown here at the local Stanley Miller Library when we present Barry Zwicker and Robert Bassamo, who will be here May 2nd, 2009 on Saturday from 1 p.m. till 5. Hope you can come.
Hey, welcome back. Let's see what the events calendar is telling us. Here is an announcement. Starting next Wednesday, for parents, you can ease your stress, the struggles, and stay sane in dealing with your teenager. I think my mom probably wanted to go to that one. I was a little tough on her. But, well, maybe she was a little tough on me. I don't know. I don't know. there we are. That is the Campus Community Updates. You are listening to CHLY 101.7 FM from downtown Nanaimo. You can visit us online at chly.ca. Now, I've got to decide what I'm going to do for the rest of the show. It is 9:47-ish. The Stephen Greer piece is 12 minutes long, so I have a feeling that that's where we're going to be going. And like I told you at the beginning of the show, I've been looking into this New World Order stuff for a couple of years now. I'm not saying that I fully understand it, because that's absolutely not the case. I have a vague outline of what's going on by the power elite, and
It's kind of scary, but I'm continuing to branch into, well, things that are grabbing my interest. And one of them that is doing that is the UFO phenomenon. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I have a feeling that if you took a rather long and fair look into the evidence from many, many different situations and persons, and there really is a lot there. So this is a piece by the director and creator of the Disclosure Project. And what Stephen Greer has done is he's collecting, well, basically whistleblowers to give their, I guess, a confession, and they also all agree that they're willing to go before Congress to testify under oath that, you know, they're telling the goods. So at this press conference, this happened in May 2001, Stephen Greer and a number of these high-ranking former officials had the press club, and they gave their, I guess, a conference-type deal there, all of them giving a quick little five-minute blurb on what their expertise is and what information they have. It's a fascinating video. I will link to, excuse me, again, I do link to everything that appears on the show. So, why don't we just get that on? Because it's 9:49 right now, 12 minutes. Ray out there, I'm going to steal a minute off your show, buddy. But, okay, it's been a fantastic show. We talked to Barry Zwicker, a fantastic guy and a great truth advocate for the 9/11 cause and, well, just global peace in general. He was a peacenik long before he was a truth activist. So let us move on to Stephen Greer speaking at the National Press Club, May 9th, 2001. And that's going to do it for the show. Friends, we will see you next week with the Fun Drive. Yes, indeed. Jesse Schroeder, Bob Hansen will be in studio with me and going to tell you all the great reasons on why you need to keep CHLY on the air. So there it is. Love and respect to you. I'll see you next week. Good night.
I'm going to introduce a man who says, there are more things between heaven and hell than any of us have accepted. And I have the witnesses and the documents to prove it. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stephen Greer.
Thank you very much, John. Members of the press, the American public, and people of the world. We are here today to disclose the truth about a subject that has been ridiculed and questioned, denied for at least 50 years. The men and women who are on this stage and the some 350 additional military intelligence witnesses to the so-called UFO matter and extraterrestrial intelligence can prove and will prove that we are not alone. I would like to thank Sarah McClendon, who is with us today, the famed White House correspondent, for her sponsorship of this meeting. Thank you very much, Sarah. In 1993, a group of military advisors to this project and I met out in the countryside in Virginia, and we decided that it was time for civilians, military, intelligence, and other people to come together to disclose the truth about the subject, which is called UFOs. Since that time, I have personally briefed a sitting Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, President Clinton's first CIA director. I have personally briefed the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the head of Intelligence Joint Staff, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, many members of Congress, members of the European leadership, the Japanese cabinet, and others. And what I have found is that none of them are surprised that this is true, but they are uniformly horrified that they have not had access to these projects. We can establish through these witnesses whom we have identified, which now number over 400, And these are people who have been inside the CIA, NSA, NRO, Air Force, Navy, Marines, Army, all divisions of the intelligence and military community, as well as corporate witnesses, contractors to the government. And these are folks who have been involved in so-called black budget or covert unacknowledged projects. These unacknowledged special access projects are taking in at least $40 to $80 billion per year. And they are sitting on technologies that can change the world forever. The reason we are coming forward now is that we are asking for the U.S. Congress and for President Bush to move towards an official inquiry and disclosure on this subject. It has the most profound implications for the human future, for the U.S. national security, and for world peace. Specifically, technologies connected to UFO and extraterrestrial vehicles, if declassified and used for peaceful energy generation and propulsion, would solve the looming energy crisis definitively, would end global warming, would correct the environmental challenges that the Earth is facing. It is also critical that we begin to debate as a society the propriety of placing weapons in space. If indeed, as we can prove, it is true that we are not alone and that space is territory which we are sharing with other civilizations, it could be a very imprudent, destabilizing thing to place weapons in space. This is not being debated because it is off the national and international radar screens. It needs to be placed on it, and we are here today to do it. We can establish through this testimony that these objects of extraterrestrial origin have been tracked on radar going thousands of miles per hour, stopping and making right-hand turns. That they use anti-gravity propulsion systems, which we have already figured out how they work in classified projects in the United States, Great Britain, and elsewhere. That these objects have landed on terra firma, at times have been disabled, and have been retrieved specifically by teams within the United States. That extraterrestrial life forms have been retrieved, and their vehicles have been taken and studied thoroughly for at least 50 years. We can prove through the testimony and documents that we will be presenting that this subject has been hidden from members of Congress and at least two administrations that we are aware of, presidential administrations, and that the Constitution of the United States has been subverted by the growing power of these classified projects, and that this is a danger to the national security. There is no evidence, I wish to emphasize, that these life forms from elsewhere are hostile towards us. But there is a great deal of evidence that they are concerned with our hostility. There are times when they have neutralized or rendered inert the launch capabilities of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Witnesses here today will describe those events to you. They have shown clearly that they do not want us to weaponize space. And yet we are proceeding down that dangerous path. And it will be established that these projects, because they have not been supervised properly by the Congress, by the U.S. President, by the international community, have become a threat to the national security. And for this reason, we feel we must disclose the facts. This is the beginning of the campaign for disclosure. And in a memo that I wrote to President Bush last week, I stated that this campaign will persist until our goals are met, and they are as follows. That we have open, honest hearings on the subject in the U.S. Congress. That there be a permanent ban on the weaponization of space or the targeting of any objects of extraterrestrial origin. That there be a full and complete study of classified technologies connected to this subject to see how they could be properly declassified and applied for peaceful energy generation so that the world may get off of fossil fuels in enough time to prevent greater ecosystem damage or war over the looming energy crisis, which is sure to sweep the Earth in the coming decade. This is a matter of the most pressing import. It has been ridiculed, yes. I know many in the media would like to talk about little green men. But in reality, the subject is laughed at because it is so serious. I have had grown men weep who are in the Pentagon, who are members of Congress, and who have said to me, what are we going to do? Here's what we will do. We will see that this matter is properly disclosed, and these courageous witnesses, the first 21 of over 100 that we have already interviewed on videotape, have stepped forward to speak the truth. Now, I expect people to be skeptical, but not irrationally so, because these men and women have come forward and they have their credentials, they can establish who they are, and they have been firsthand witnesses to some of the most important events in the history of the human race. As was pointed out to me by some of the men here, they were charged with handling the nuclear weapons of the United States. Their word was trusted on everything of great importance for the national security. We must trust their word now. As Monsignor Balducci said at the Vatican, in an interview I had with him recently, it is irrational not to accept the testimony of these witnesses. So please be skeptical. But that is not the same as prejudiced and closed-minded. This is a matter of great importance, and I ask the media, the scientific community, and the political community to look seriously at this matter and to do the right thing for humanity and for our children. We have available for the media and for members of Congress a nearly 500-page briefing document with transcripts from dozens of these top-secret witnesses. We have a four-hour videotape summary. It's not a commercial product, I warn you, from this project of the 120 hours that we have in interviews so far. They've been boiled down to 4 hours, and it's available for the Congress to review and for the major media to review. We can establish that this subject is real and has tremendous significance for the human future. I ask on all of you who are listening to contact the members of Congress that represent you and the leaders around the world and other countries and ask them to hold an honest inquiry into this subject to support a ban on weaponizing space, since we are sharing space with other life forms, and that we move quickly as a people to understanding that this is the end of the childhood of the human race. It is time for us to become mature adults in the cosmic civilizations out there. To do this, we must become a peaceful civilization, and we must look as we go into space with an intent of cooperating with other civilizations, not weaponizing that high frontier.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.